Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Natalie Bellini. We are very excited to bring you a special This Year in Medicine edition of Diabetes Dialogue. In this installment of our Year of the Incretin Therapy Celebration, we are joined today by Dr. Tim Garvey to discuss tirzepatide. So, Dr. Garvey, if you wouldn't mind, we've had you on our podcast before, so we're really excited to have you again. But for those that maybe didn't tune in before or don't remember, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself.
Well, sure. I'm always happy to join Diana and Natalie in these discussions. It's always a lot of fun. You've got my name right, Tim Garvey. I am an endocrinologist. I'm a professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, UAB. I'm in the Department of Nutrition Sciences, and I'm head of our NIH-funded Diabetes Research Center, and I've been studying diabetes and obesity my whole academic career, so I'm happy to talk about tirzepatide. I think we're really at a transformational change in our ability to take care of patients with obesity and all the family of obesity-related diseases that respond to weight loss. Tirzepatide, just by way of introduction, I consider it the second of what I'm classifying as second-generation obesity medicines. The first generation were all approved in 2014 or before, and in clinical trials, they averaged less than 10% weight loss. With the second-generation medicines, semaglutide and now tirzepatide, we're getting 15% or more, and that just brings so much more clinical benefits to the table in terms of its ability to prevent and treat a broad array of obesity-related complications. So tirzepatide is the newer kid on the block, right? So I think, you know, by way of clarification, it's Mounjaro is the brand name when it's used to treat diabetes. And now it's just a month in November of 2023, it was approved for obesity without diabetes. Same medicine, same molecule, but now it's called Zepbound for obesity.
Yeah, we're very excited. And I believe it's just gotten into pharmacies and people will be able to order it and everything. So we know that you were instrumental in terms of especially the first two SURMOUNT clinical trials, SURMOUNT 1 and 2, which is really what got the drug approved for obesity. That's what's in the package label. There are, of course, now there's also SURMOUNT 3 and 4. But if you wouldn't mind, if we could start with SURMOUNT 1 and 2, and you can just provide us maybe with an overview. What did we see and why, you know, kind of how that contributed to the FDA now approving it for this indication?
Yeah, I was present when the SURMOUNT 1 data were presented at the ADA meeting, and it just left the audience with a gasp. I tell you, the efficacy of this medicine is remarkable. We haven't had head-to-head trials so much, but the weight loss compared to the placebo group was just dramatic. Those randomized to placebo is about a 2% weight loss or so. Those randomized to tirzepatide, there were 5, 10, and 15 milligram per week doses, but at the 10 and 15 milligram doses, it was like 22% weight loss over 72 weeks. Now, SURMOUNT 1 was just patients with obesity, okay, not diabetes. Some patients had prediabetes, but it was just treating obesity. Again, 22% weight loss, and the categorical weight loss was also really dramatic. Approaching the levels of weight loss we see with bariatric surgery techniques is really kind of closing the gap there. And this weight loss was accompanied by a lot of metabolic benefits, improvements in cardiovascular risk factors like blood pressure, the inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, waist circumference, but also improvements in metabolic risk factors, a decrease in hemoglobin A1C, even though these subjects didn't have diabetes at baseline, but they still had a drop in hemoglobin A1C. There was a drop in fasting glucose and fasting insulin, both together, that was really marked decrements. And this is indicative of an increase in insulin sensitivity. And then there was a big decrease in triglycerides, improvements in lipids. So, and it converted patients who were pre-diabetes at baseline, 80% of them then became normal glycemic, unlike the placebo group, where even 4% went on to get diabetes. So it converts pre-diabetes to normal glycemia. And we know from another trial, the SELECT trial, it also prevents progression to diabetes. So a lot of metabolic benefits and a whole heck of a lot of weight loss in patients with obesity. That's SURMOUNT-1. And really it was responsible for the approval, very recent approval of tirzepatide, i.e. Zepbound, for obesity.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So exciting. I know in practice, we're seeing some amazing things. Of course, we've been using the Mounjaro version so far because that's what was FDA approved until now. But just really profound in terms of getting people just coming off of insulin, those wearing CGM, you just see the all the variability. And now it's like it's all flat, narrow, in range. A1C is really like just totally normalizing. I mean, it's been quite profound what we're seeing.
Yeah. And also people saying how much better they feel, right? I'm very interested in the inflammatory markers in all of this, because in the early ages with when Victoza, when liraglutide daily came out, we did some early studies with type 1 and people would come back and say, I feel better. Like, well, you know, your glucose isn't, you know, is more in range and this and that. No, I feel better. I'm less depressed. I feel like I have more energy. And I think this is all about that inflammation that diabetes and as well as pre-diabetes, as well as obesity can cause.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right, Natalie. It's probably multi-componential why patients feel better. Of course, less inflammation, more insulin sensitive, but, you know, just carrying around, you know, 22% less body weight than you had originally. I mean, these trials were, you know, quality of life and physical capability was assessed by questionnaire, and there was improvements there, particularly physical functioning, a big improvement there. So that's bound to make people happier, you know?
Absolutely. I you know, that the ability to measure how many steps can you take before becoming out of breath? How far can you go? Those markers are that it's an incredible increase in stamina for people to then say, I can walk a little further. I can do a little more. I love it. I love that they measured those things as well.
Right. Yeah.
I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, like, with SURMOUNT-2, I know that was done in people with type 2 diabetes, and the weight loss wasn't, I mean, it was still quite impressive, but it wasn't as much as we saw in SURMOUNT-1. And if you could just talk a little bit about kind of some of the hypotheses of why it tends to be there's less weight loss in people that have diabetes.
Right. Yeah. I think I guess it'd be a little confusing, these trials. You know, the SURPASS studies were using tirzepatide to treat diabetes, okay? So those trials were shorter because you can assess hemoglobin A1C control a lot quicker than you can body weight. There were, you had to have diabetes irrespective of baseline BMI. I mean, patients with a BMI of 25 could be enrolled in the SURPASS studies. And hemoglobin A1C was the primary outcome. So those studies were just focused on diabetes, whereas SURMOUNT-2 was treating obesity in diabetes, okay? So it was a longer study, 72 weeks. Weight loss was the primary outcome measure. You had to have a BMI of 27 or above. So it was a different, little different nuance in the study. It's treating obesity in diabetes. And so getting done to SURMOUNT-2, now this was, as I indicated, this was, you had to have both obesity and diabetes, unlike SURMOUNT-1. And you're right, with any intervention, and this is all of the medicines, this is lifestyle, there's about 30% less weight loss with any intervention if you have both diabetes and obesity than if you just have obesity alone. Right. And we don't really understand the reason. You know, I think, you know, patients can be on medicines like sulfonylureas and insulin that do promote weight gain. After all, insulin is a state of impaired substrate metabolism. I mean, your fat oxidation, just substrate oxidation and fuel metabolism is impaired. And so I think, you know, it's just a different metabolic state. We don't quite understand this difference. But looking at tirzepatide in patients with obesity and diabetes, in SURMOUNT-2, I thought it was pretty remarkable. There was 15.7% weight loss and in these patients. So we're still at this second-generation level efficacy of 15% or above. And remember, we have to treat both of these diseases, obesity and diabetes, and we have to treat them both effectively. And so we really want that second-generation level weight loss to treat obesity, which, of course, happened. But it's the hemoglobin A1C response that I always also found remarkable. It fell from about a baseline of 8.1 or 8.2%. down to about 5.7% or 5.67%. So a dramatic decrease in hemoglobin A1C. 80 to 90% of patients reached the hemoglobin A1C targets of 7%, the ADA, or 6% or less, the ACE recommended target. But what was really remarkable is over half of the patients achieved normal hemoglobin A1C. Less than 5.7%. And all of this was accomplished with little or no hypoglycemia. Level 2 hypoglycemia, which is just a blood sugar less than 54 milligrams per deciliter, don't even have to have symptoms, was, you know, 4 to 5%. And there was no severe hypoglycemia, where you need assistance from somebody else to kind of deal with the situation. So, you know, I started my internship when we had NPH and regular insulin, sulfonylureas, then metformin came along and we're dancing in the streets, you know. And to think we could get normal hemoglobin A1Cs without hypoglycemia, I never thought we'd see that day. So the way I look at this is the best medicine for obesity in patients with obesity and diabetes, and also the best medicine for diabetes. And you know, so one medicine takes care of both of these diseases optimally. So I just think those results are so impressive.
Oh, it's phenomenal. I mean, we you know, you're talking early in your career, even 5 or 6 years ago, we couldn't have, you know, very little hypoglycemia and these kinds of results on top of it without what? Weight gain. I can give someone enough insulin to create almost any A1C we want. The problem is the hypoglycemia, but also the weight gain. You over-insulinize someone, and they come back. And we see this a lot when we do the consulting in endocrinology. It's like, I gained 4 pounds last year, and then 3 more, and then 5 more. And I think to myself already, all immediately, you're on too much basal insulin. You're on too much insulin in general. They just keep upping it. This is allowing us to treat the diabetes without weight gain. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. And the health benefits here, you know, I've been thinking about this. Diabetes is not just an entity unto itself, right? It's part of the nexus of cardiometabolic diseases, okay? So we really have to think about diabetes and treat it in this larger context. Well, what do I mean by that? So cardiometabolic disease starts with insulin resistance. It's made worse by obesity, subclinical, until you start developing things like prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, hepatic steatosis, prehypertension, dyslipidemia. Then you know the patient is insulin resistant and has cardiometabolic disease, and you know they're at risk of going to the end stage manifestations of this disease, which is cardiovascular disease, congestive heart failure, stroke, diabetes, NASH, hypertension, and then these conspire to impair kidney function, which accelerates atherosclerosis. So all of these diseases go together. And when you develop diabetes, it means you're at risk or may have one or all of those other end-stage manifestations of cardiometabolic disease. So we have to treat the patient holistically and comprehensively to prevent and treat any of those end-stage manifestations that are there. So that's where I think these second-generation obesity medicines really play. They really are cardiometabolic disease drugs because both semaglutide and tirzepatide, because we talked about the effects on obesity and diabetes, but we now know that semaglutide improves heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and there's a tirzepatide trial ongoing and to assess the same outcome. We know that semaglutide improves NASH histology, and there's a tirzepatide trial ongoing to assess the same kind of thing. And we know that from the SELECT study, there was a 20% decrease in the hazard ratio for the MACE events, you know, major adverse cardiovascular events. So it's cardioprotective. It's life-saving. It's cardioprotective over and above statins and angiotensin blockade with blood pressure control. So it's 20% protection on top of all of that. And there's a tirzepatide trial, a morbidity and mortality outcomes trial also ongoing to assess these things. And then kidney disease. There was a trial called the FLOW trial with semaglutide. This was 1 milligram semaglutide in diabetes, assessing a composite renal outcome. And this trial was stopped prematurely for efficacy. So we know it meant that it met the composite outcome. The data haven't been released yet. So these are renal protective. And there's a tirzepatide trial, which is tirzepatide's a little behind semaglutide in all of these aspects, assessing that also. So listen, these medicines can treat all of these things or prevent all of those. That's why I say they're cardiometabolic disease medicines. And it's transformational. That's the best word I can come up with.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know we're really looking forward to seeing the cardiovascular outcomes with tirzepatide. I think we're really hopeful, especially, like you said, the SELECT trial with semaglutide, right, that we will see that, or maybe even more with tirzepatide, but we definitely can't wait to see that. I am curious if you could speak a little bit. So in the last month or two, we've also had now SURMOUNT 3 and 4 get published, and those were kind of unique trials. So if you could just talk a little bit about that and kind of what they saw in those studies.
Yeah, I think these add a little bit to the overall picture here. You know, SURMOUNT 3 was, you know, you had to, a lead in, you had to lose 5% of your body weight, and then you could be randomized. And so the idea was, so it's kind of a select intake population who had already responded. And then with, ongoing tirzepatide treatment, there was even greater weight loss in this study by the end, but about 26% weight loss. And then SURMOUNT 4 was kind of a standard protocol that's done with obesity medicines where you get patients to reach their equilibrium weight loss level. Then you randomize patients to placebo or control and see if the weight comes back on placebo. And of course it did, and it does with every obesity medicine ever tested. So I'm not surprised by that result, but it does underscore the fact that these pathophysiological drivers of weight that generate excess adiposity and sustain excess adiposity are still there and working against the patient.
Right.
The medicine takes care of it while you're on the medicine, but you go off the medicine, they raise their ugly heads again, and you start getting more weight regain. It drives weight regain. Is that the patient's fault? You know, they're fighting against this pathology, and that's what happens. And that's what happened in SURMOUNT 4.
And I just think it's so interesting because I've heard other clinicians say, well, this person has to stay on this for life. Well, I don't start a statin and ever stop it, right? I don't start, you know, most of the time anyway, blood pressure medicine. Now, sometimes I'll reduce it or, you know, adjust it or take one off and add a different one. Yeah. But most of the time, people are on some sort of blood pressure medicine for life. Why would we ever, you know, stop an obesity medicine? And I think we need to, as clinicians, really message that this, you know, when did the AMA finally decide that obesity was actually a disease at all? And that we just follow through and say, this makes sense. We should continue these medications because it's as important as controlling any of the other diseases that we treat as chronic diseases.
So true, Natalie. It's just that we have to think about obesity as a chronic disease, as adiposity-based chronic disease, which is the diagnostic term that's been endorsed by American Association of Clinical Endocrinology and the European Association for the Study of Obesity. You know, when you use the term BMI, you use the term obesity, you think BMI. But we know this disease is a lot more than BMI. And that's why I like adiposity-based chronic disease, because it tells you what we're treating, adiposity-based abnormalities in mass distribution and function of adipose tissue, and why we treat it. It's a chronic disease, like you say, that's lifelong. and is associated with complications that impair health and confer morbidity and mortality. But, you know, I think the one difference between hypertension medicines and these newer weight loss medicines is price and accessibility, okay?
Yes.
And we really got to solve that problem. Well, we have to, and we don't know how to manage these medicines over the lifetime of a patient. You know, I can tell you there's a couple trials on the books for in clinicaltrials.gov. It's in the public domain of, you know, where they both with semaglutide and tirzepatide, they get patients down to their equilibrium weight loss level. Then they go on a lower dose for maintenance, you know, the lower dose to see how if that's sufficient. So I'm glad to see these trials kind of orienting now to more long-term, you know, approaches to more long-term care using these medicines.
I love that idea.
That's yeah. Really interesting because I can tell you, like, anecdotally in practice, a lot of people are taking it, like, tirzepatide every 2 weeks or 3 weeks to try to maintain it, mostly because related to cost and stuff. But it seems to be working, at least for maintenance of weight loss. So it's very interesting. Well, as we get ready to wrap up this episode, we so appreciate all your time and everything. We'd like to kind of conclude by asking what you think the next 5 or 10 years might look like for tirzepatide and the landscape of incretin therapies.
Oh, my goodness. I tell you, it's the future is so bright. I mean, we're in a unique period in medicine here. You know, there's retatrutide, which is a triple agonist, GIP, GLP-1, and glucagon, producing second-generation level weight loss in phase 2 trials with shorter duration. Same with this combination of a long-acting amylin plus semaglutide, cagrilintide plus semaglutide, known as CagriSema. Tremendous weight loss in phase 2 studies, short-term. Second generation level, even in diabetes. There's a survodutide, which is a GLP-1 glucagon dual agonist. Again, second generation level efficacy in phase 2 trials. All of these are in phase 3 trials now. And other developments. We're going to have a lot of tools. And, you know, something we're going to have to think more about is how much weight loss is enough? And these medicines are so powerful. When do we have too much weight loss? Okay. Natalie was describing how these patients feel better. But sometimes, you know, if they lose too much weight too fast, they don't feel so good. I have noticed kind of a fatigue-like syndrome where they're kind of listless. They don't feel as cognitively intact, and they're just losing too much weight. They don't have an appetite. And they're not getting enough calcium and iron and protein in some instances. So we have to pay more attention to diet quality than reduced calorie diets sometimes. And so we have to really manage weight loss with these more powerful medicines in a more with a greater perspective in terms of, you know, have we met our health benefits? So we met our health goals at whatever level of weight loss we're at. Do we need to lose more? Is it going to be good for the patient to lose more? How are they feeling? Are they, and this whole issue of sarcopenia, you know, losing too much lean mass, that's being talked up a lot. It is important. We need more data. I myself haven't noticed a big problem here. When patients lose all this weight, they're more functional and more, you know, we have them going up, at the beginning, we see how many stairs they can walk up. And both after the weight loss, they're much better at it.
Absolutely. Right.
You know, we could have them doing the 6-minute walk test, but then they'd be walking all over the clinic, you know, so we can't do that. But I just haven't, but it's still something, you know, particularly in elderly people where resistance exercise as part of the lifestyle becomes important. But all of these things we're going to have to think about now when we have this array of drugs with this degree of efficacy.
I love it.
I think that's a great note to end on because I think I still think this doesn't replace lifestyle, healthy lifestyle behaviors. And that's so important. And so we want people, of course, to eat healthy, whole grain.
Exercise, make good decisions.
Right.
So, well, we want to thank you so much, Dr. Garvey, for this wonderful discussion and all of your insights. We so appreciate it. I'm sure the audience really appreciates it. So thanks everyone for tuning in. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.